Kickstart your day at 7 and get the news you need from the perspective you want. News One Now with Roland Martin, every weekday morning at 7 on TV One.
Good morning, I'm Roland Martin. Next on News One Now, President Barack Obama makes history, more history, by agreeing to commute more than 200 sentences, plus his approval ratings continue to climb. We'll hear from U.S. Attorney General Loretta Lynch calling for more police accountability as she spoke to the National Association of Black Journalists. Folks, journalism, Mark Lamont Hill is here with his new book, Nobody, Casualties of America's War on the Vulnerable, from Ferguson to Flint and beyond. Plus, we have highlights from Education Secretary John King's presentation to NABJ on yesterday. We'll also hear from Tika Sumter, Parker Sawyer. They're in the House to discuss their new movie about the first date of President Barack Obama and First Lady Michelle Obama. Plus, my chat with Will Smith, Viola Davis, and their castmates about the new movie, DC Comics superhero film, Suicide Squad. News One Now starts right now.
Even as that slow process of criminal justice reform goes forward, what I wanted to see is if we could reinvigorate the pardon process and commutation process that had become stalled.
214 more federal inmates sentences commuted by President Barack Obama took place on yesterday at a news conference at the Pentagon. The president talked about his decision to use his constitutional power to shorten the sentences of more federal inmates. The early release of mostly low-level drug offenders is part of the president's effort to correct what he views as unreasonable, long, mandatory minimum sentences. With 562 total commutations during his presidency, President Obama has now commuted more federal inmates than any president since Calvin Coolidge. But critics say the president has neglected traditional pardons, saying they are more useful to former offenders looking for jobs or trying to restore their voting or gun rights. But the president says his term is not over yet.
Our focus really has been on people who we think were overcharged, and people who we do not believe have a propensity towards violence. The process that I've put in place is not going to vary depending on how close I get to the election. So it's going to be reviewed by the pardon attorney. It'll be reviewed by my White House counsel. And I'm going to, as best as I can, make these decisions based on the merits as opposed to political considerations.
Folks, this particular issue has been significant for quite some time because, again, the president has made it a point during his presidency to talk about this issue, to confront this issue. He had called for Attorney General Eric Holder to order a massive review of the commutation process because it was the folks at ProPublica who did a piece talking about how there was a serious problem in the particular department or office of the Department of Justice that was preventing these commutations coming to the president's desk. Also yesterday, the president also commuted the sentence of a Denver Broncos player. His grandmother had been sentenced to prison, a life term in prison, but he also commuted that sentence. He earlier had commuted the sentence of his mother. I want to go to our panel right here. We have Yolanda Young, attorney as well, Ray Baker, Ray Baker Media, Rhonda Fahmy, former associate, in the Department of Energy under President Bush. Folks, this is one of probably the most important things any president can do, and that is being able to commute a pardon sentences.
Sure.
And even with these commutations, the president was criticized early on because they were coming extremely slow. When they ordered this review, thousands of people applied for the commutation, and many of them met the criteria. And they even put a call out to lawyers, mm-hmm. Yolanda, to assist in this because they didn't have enough people to examine these applications.
Sure. I will say this. Yes, it's wonderful what he's done so far, but not to be a wet blanket, These commutations don't go far enough. I had the opportunity to ask Kemba Woods, who, as you recall, became a poster child for these long drug sentences. And I asked her if she thought the laws had gone far enough, and she said no, mm-hmm. because under the guidelines, she would still be in prison. because, in fact, under conspiracy laws, even though she never handled any drugs, she would still be considered having been a part of a conspiracy with someone who was a major drug dealer. So the commutations don't go far enough.
And Ray, when we talk about commutations, again, the critics are saying, look, pardon is a whole different deal. Because it is certainly restoring those rights. It essentially wipes it out. A commutation, they're happy with it, but it's totally different from a pardon.
Absolutely. You're correct. One of the things I think, though, that's important is the work of journalists like Daphna Linzer that you alluded to in the ProPublica piece, how important it was to identify the backlog of those who were trapped and not getting pardons and or commutations. So what we want to do is try to restore the rights of many returning citizens, give them the opportunity to engage in the process. Because if we're going to identify jail or prisons as rehabilitative, we need to have opportunity to have these folks be rehabilitated.
Rhonda?
Yeah, I think one of the big issues here in this election season has been the addiction problem, and the addiction problem is spreading. And so I think the president has a little more leeway here politically to do this. In other cases, he wouldn't have, because people truly believe these are, you know, if they're drug offenders and they're not violent criminals, why not? They don't need prison. What they need is rehabilitation in the form of other sorts of outpatient treatment, especially if they haven't committed crimes. The problem, Roland, is the restoration of those voting rights. A lot of folks in this political season, like what Governor Terry McAuliffe did, are going to cry foul because somehow they're going to try to stack the voting rules in favor of what people assume to be the Democrats.
Well, first of all, anybody who's crying about what Governor Terry McAuliffe did refuses to even pay attention to what he said when he based it on why that law was put in place. It was specifically put in place to target black people. And that's first. Second of all, anybody who's crying about that, largely Republicans, also the same folks who have been leading voter suppression efforts all across this country. And so I don't really want to hear a damn thing from any of those folks when what they've done is blocked efforts by more people to vote, or what they've also done, been silent as many of those bills have been passed in states all across this country.
But they pushed back on Terry McAuliffe. Remember what he did? He tried to do the blanket. And
right.
The court said, no way. The court said, you've got to do this one by one.
And he has.
Individually.
And he has.
Individually.
And he has. And by and they're still mad. Mark Lamont Hill, on this particular issue, the president's commutations, again, he makes a point, well, my presidency is not over, but when you have thousands of people who qualify under the criteria they established, yeah, and only 500 plus have been done, many are saying, "Dude, you got to move." And remember, there's no law that says the president only can do this once a month.
Right.
He literally can issue
every
commutations every day.
Right. I think he's worried about doing too much because of how it might play in the election cycle. I think he's going to do similar to what Bill Clinton did in 2000, which is right around the last day, do a lot of commutation. Of course, Bill Clinton didn't do it for people with nonviolent drug offenses. He did it for his friends and other people.
Like Mark Rich.
Exactly.
Who's very rich.
Very rich. But it will be interesting to see what President Obama does toward the end, because the federal level, this can be done. Of course, the biggest concern is that so many of us have nonviolent drug offenses on the state level. Obviously, there's nothing President Obama can do about that, but we need to find a way to rally governors to do the same thing.
It was interesting to me, you have Bob Goodlatte, of course, who is the head of the House Judiciary Committee, who all of a sudden he's complaining, oh, he's deeply concerned about the president's size and scope of the commutations. But Congressman, read the Constitution. See, I love these constitutional experts, these strict constructionists who complain about the president taking this action when it's in the Constitution. Is right there. It's real clear. But they still want to find something to whine about. It's in, he has the absolute power to do this. And only him. He doesn't need Congress's permission to do any of this.
Right. They're mad because of who's being let out. Let's be honest here. If you know,
more voters.
Yeah, more voters who they think aren't going to vote for them.
Absolutely.
And but he literally says the president's actions, quote, are a blatant usurpation of Congress's authority. Dude, how is he usurping Congress's authority when the Constitution
job, right,
says only he, in fact, Congress doesn't have the authority.
Right.
He has the authority.
No, he is. It's absolutely bizarre. It's just a talking point because they think it'll rally
voters.
And he's
from Virginia. Did you mention that, Roland? He's also from Virginia. So again, he's not only pushing back on President Obama, he's pushing back on his own governor, Terry McAuliffe, for what he's done.
And
in the
he's been the one that people have been lobbying for to mm-hmm. come back for to revisit VRA, excuse me, since the Supreme Court has gutted it.
Not just VRA.
And so many
criminal
other
justice reform.
Criminal justice VRA. So many different things that he's been the one that folks have been coming to saying, let's get this done. John Conyers is doing monumental work there, but as the chairman, it's up to Congressman Goodlatte to do that work, and he's been dragging his feet. And as Dr. Hill alluded to, it's just partisan talk.
And again, if y'all want to laugh, let's laugh. He says, I am deeply concerned that President Obama has continued his part in power for a total of 562 commutations during his presidency. Additionally, the fact that the Justice Department's clemency initiative is focused solely on federal drug offenders continues this administration's plainly unconstitutional practice of picking and choosing which laws to enforce and which laws to change. Okay. The Constitution says you can grant a pardon for anybody,
right.
For anything.
who do you want to let out? Tax offenders? I mean, who do you want to let out?
Literally, the president has the power to pardon or commute a triple murderer.
Right.
I mean, that's the. So I just love the, again, these strict constructionists who love to complain.
He's up for election. He's up for election.
Yeah. No, but it would be great.
He's up for election.
It would be great if this trifling congressman would actually just own up to the fact that, yes, the President of the United States possesses the power
Absolutely.
That was put in the Constitution by the Founding Fathers. Mm-hmm. You know, the document we love to love. Maybe Mr. Khan, Kazir Khan, should send Bob Goodlatte one of those pocket constitutions for him to read. Let's talk yesterday, folks, at NABJ, National Association of Black Journalists. U.S. Attorney General Loretta Lynch was there. She's calling for more accountability and transparency in police departments across the country. She outlined her plan to help bridge the gap between the community and police officers. Here's what she had to say.
The one thing that does come up, every city that I visit, every group that I talk to, is the importance of having a relationship between law enforcement and the community before the incident happens. Accountability, to me, as a concept, is more than just, can the Justice Department bring a lawsuit? It's also, can your local prosecutors bring a case? Because fundamentally, our local prosecutors themselves have to be accountable to the communities that either elect them or appoint them. I mean, they literally do represent a very specific community. And so we at DOJ try and support those prosecutions also. But it even goes back further. The accountability has to start at the law enforcement level. People also need to see law enforcement organizations dealing with issues of any kind of police misconduct. Obviously, we've all seen the most serious examples. People have lost their lives. But there's a whole range of other disciplinary issues that police departments confront. So one of the things that we've seen be very effective is when community groups focus on that issue and they say, you know what? Not only do we need accountability, we need transparency. So we want to have a system whereby we, the community, know what your disciplinary routine is, you know, to their local law enforcement. We want to know what kind of infractions lead to what kind of discipline. And we want to see the records of that. And where police departments can actually do that, they will make great strides. So accountability as a concept starts at the very beginning of this police relationship, because we have to see law enforcement officers and entities themselves saying, as they often say to me, they'll say to me all the time, you know, we don't accept bad police behavior. We get rid of people who cross the line. And, you know, and I will say to them, that's great. And I've seen that because I work with law enforcement. And I'll say, but you know, the general public does not see that.
Right.
You know, you need to understand that people do not have that perception of you because they do not see that. So the challenge for law enforcement is how can they bring transparency into a system as well as accountability into a system?
You believe the community has confidence that the Department of Justice would do anything?
No.
Absolutely not.
Absolutely not. I've been on the ground talking to folk for the last 2 years about this, and people believe that there's no point. After the Trayvon Martin death, after Mike Brown, there were civil rights charges being brought. There was a DOJ investigation, and people felt like there was no outcome that was substantive. Now, that's not entirely fair, because it's almost impossible to pull a civil rights case out of this. But people are very frustrated. The other thing here that I saw that was missing was a lack of concrete steps. Like, I want to hear words like civilian review board. I want to hear words like accountability in very concrete ways, because this is important, but it's lip service if it doesn't have any teeth attached.
Right. And the fact of the matter is, it has to happen on the local level. I mean, we like seeing the federal government come in and you know, give us a report and reveal some truths about what's going on in these cities. But the bottom line is, you've got to put pressure on the mayor, the police chief, the elected sheriff, the state legislatures. That is where this system gets changed.
And look, we are 2 years removed from Eric Garner being killed, and right. still nothing from the Department of Justice yet on whether or not those cops will be tried for violating civil rights.
They won't be.
One of the things that we saw just yesterday, Dr. David Leonard out of Washington State University co-authored a piece in the Washington Post about police don't need to hug black people, they need to just stop killing them. And one of the things that that piece alluded to specifically was this idea of accountability, concrete steps. If we're going to say that jail and punishment through the court criminal justice system is going to be a deterrent to murder among citizens, it also needs to be a deterrent to murder among those involved in law enforcement. And so when we see time and time again, these situations we're under, at the very least, dubious situations, which African Americans are being killed by law enforcement, and there's nothing that comes of it, at least the conversation of it in a trial, then many Americans are disappointed and feel like justice is not being served.
I need the Attorney General to be far more forceful with that last particular point when she said, when I talk to cops, they'll say this to me privately. No, I need the Attorney General, I need the head of the FBI to say, it is time for police officers to stop being quiet about misconduct right. among their fellow officers and speak publicly and forcefully. Because here's the piece. One of the reasons an officer gets blackballed is because that officer is going to be there all alone. But if all of a sudden you have a number of people speaking up, you can't blackball everybody.
That's right. That's you change the culture.
And that to me, Ron, is a problem because... And people always, the fallback, well, not all cops are bad. Well, hell, not all folks in the community are bad, but they sure as hell know how to spread the blame.
Right. Look, you've heard me say this before on your show, Roland. You know, what she hadn't said, what Loretta Lynch, the Attorney General, didn't say is this issue of the law, the qualified immunity, Roland. And I keep talking about it, not because I think it's an excuse, but because it's the law. So, actions committed in their duties, official actions, they have some immunity. Police officers have this immunity. Doesn't mean there can't be transparency and accountability and police officers stepping forward when there is misconduct. But what do you do about this immunity issue?
That can be changed by state legislature.
Yeah, that's
right.
That's
they've got a vote right now.
Well, yeah,
they've got a law.
Yeah, that was her point. When the other, but when you have a law in Louisiana, now New York State is considering one to basically give police officers to be a protected class. Mm-hmm. I mean, they literally are trying to make this thing ironclad.
Right.
The irony, though, of law enforcement often saying, well, these are just bad apples, right? Yet time and time again, Arab and particularly Muslim Arab Americans have to prove that they are willing to speak out against the bad ones, right? Willing to speak out against the bad ones. Mm-hmm. But we don't ask law enforcement to have the same courage of their convictions to speak out against, quote, the bad ones.
All right, folks, so hold tight. When we come back, we'll talk more on this issue. Also, there's a cop in Virginia who shot and killed, a former cop who shot and killed an African-American. Shocking. He got convicted and is going to prison. Well, we'll see what's sentencing. I'll talk about that when we come back. Also, Mark Mahill talks about systematic injustices that affect minorities and the poor in America in his new book, Nobody, Casualties of America's War on the Vulnerable, from Ferguson to Flint and beyond. Plus, we'll hear from the Secretary of Education, John King, about equity in education when he spoke to NABJ on yesterday, 18th of the hour. News 1 Now on TV 1.
Wherever you are, we are your centerpiece for black thoughts in America. It's News 1 Now with your host, Roland Martin.
Folks, we talk about the issue of what's taking place across this country when it comes to forfeitures, when we talk about these cities that are using police departments to frankly be revenue generators for folks in the communities, largely those who are the poor. Mark Lamont Hill believes that unregulated capitalism, public policy, and social practice are at the core of inequities that affect minorities and people of poor folks in America. The book is called Nobody, Casualties of America's War on the Vulnerable, from Ferguson to Flint and beyond. Mark joins us here to discuss this. And here's what's interesting to me. It's amazing to me how people live in complete denial about what's happening. When you see these stories about police departments with seizing goods and dealing with forfeitures,
yeah.
you have libertarians like the Koch brothers who are on the same side of liberal activists on this particular issue. When you talk about the police department, Loretta Lynch was speaking in Ferguson. When people say the DOJ report was a failure, well, no, they exposed all Ferguson and also a bunch of other towns around Ferguson doing the exact same thing, literally using police departments to target poor folks and set, and keep them further in poverty by slapping warrant after warrant, just tacking little warrants on them. That's the kind of stuff that angers community. So when you see an uprising, that's the root of a lot of this stuff.
Absolutely. It's profound frustration. You got a black community, for example, in Ferguson, you got 20,000 people and 16,000 of them got warrants or tickets that are owed. 16,000 out of 20,000. That's almost everybody. So not only does that become basically a daily tax, and turns the police force into tax collectors as opposed to people who are actually making the community safe, but it also creates the pretext for all these other interactions. Police can pull you over, run your warrant. They always have an excuse to investigate further. They always have an excuse to push you further. And this is how the Mike Brown interaction begins. Eric Garner begins for something very small, selling Lucy's. Walter Scott begins over child support. Alton Sterling begins over CDs. And it becomes these minor interactions that allow us the pretext for really what amounts to police harassment.
And what bothers me the most is that you hear people say, you guys should get over this. Pull yourself up by your bootstraps. It's not that bad. And the problem in these cases, this isn't video.
Right.
This is what sight unseen. That was a story I read where a young woman was in a car accident. Someone hit her. Child is with her. They come on the scene. All of a sudden, she has warrants. The next thing you know, they take her to jail. She's able to get out of that jail, but she had warrants in another town. They transfer her to another town. Well, four different towns they transfer her to.
Wow.
Here she gets hit by somebody else. And yesterday, even Attorney General Loretta Lynch talked about this whole issue as well in terms of all of a sudden, you can't pay $25. So they go, okay, cool, $100. And what happens is for a lot of these folks, they know they can't pay, so they don't show up.
Right.
The next thing you know, it's thousands of dollars in fines.
Exactly. Yes. And we see essentially the criminal justice system has instituted essentially poor taxes. And one of the challenges, in the book I talk about Sandra Bland, and I say Sandra Bland would probably be alive if she had $500. You know, she had a $5,000 bail for a $500 bond. She didn't have it, so she ended up staying in jail all that time, which led to all these other events. If she literally had $500, that wouldn't have happened. 84% of the people who are in jail right now are there because they don't have the money for bail. That is not how the bail system was designed. It was not designed to make sure that poor people stayed and middle class and rich people left. That it was designed to make sure people returned to court. But we have a system now that essentially punishes the poor for being poor. They are the ones in the book that I talk about that are rendered nobody.
Dr. Hill, in the book, you talk a little bit about this unregulated capitalism and how this works. Some people try to seek redress through this regarding public policy, but we heard Dr. Eddie Gloud call one of the major candidates a corporate Democrat. And so where can those who want to see changes go in a political sense? Which party, if any, which kind of public policy motif can they go toward to seek redress for this?
Well, ultimately, I think both parties have to be accountable for this. Mm-hmm. We can't look to just Democrats. We can't look to just Republicans for this. We need everybody to come up with sound public policy that shifts this. But this isn't just an electoral issue. We need to vote, and we need to vote for candidates who can help us win, particularly at the state and local level, as we've been talking about all morning. But there's also the question of how do we reimagine the legal system itself? How do we reimagine the criminal justice system itself? And how do we reimagine the role that police play in our communities? Because until we do that, we don't get anywhere. In the second chapter of the book, for example, I talk about broken windows policing. We've accepted as a community that broken windows policing makes sense, that it works, and we just need to execute it better. But the data shows, the evidence shows, and years of public policy shows that broken windows policing itself doesn't work. This idea that if we can get the ticky-tack crimes, we can stop the big stuff is simply untrue. All it does is turn police into occupying forces in our community, and it ultimately makes citizens less trusting of the police. So when big crimes do happen, black folk don't want to talk to. If something happened, I ain't calling the police. If I'm a vulnerable person, because I'm worried about the warrants, I'm worried about how they're going to treat me, and I'm worried that they won't even do anything if they catch the person.
We've heard reports, though, from Republicans who say that most of the broken window policies, most of those investigations that go on, are prompted by 311, 911 calls from citizens and communities. What can communities do to police themselves?
That's a great question. And I think one of the things we have to do, again, is reimagine the role of police in our community. So self-policing is important. I think we need to sort of invigorate our energy around Neighborhood Watch. We need to actually be in our own corners. There's nothing that stops us from standing on the corners and observing our own neighborhoods. There's nothing that stops us from also policing the police. Cop watch programs, when I was in Ferguson, we saw them really developing, and they were beginning to teach people around the nation and do trainings in Ferguson for cop watch programs around the country. LA, San Francisco, Philadelphia, we've all begun to do cop watch programs, which allow people to sort of stand at a safe distance and survey what the police are doing. There are other things that we can do, but those are good starts.
Are police resistant to that, or?
Not explicitly, but in real life, when I actually watch cop watch programs, yes, sure. They are very, very uncomfortable with
it. Hey, Shelly, do me a favor. I want to go to my iPad because this is the perfect example. Many people have seen this story of this Kentucky judge who just goes off when this black woman is in jail for 3 days and she doesn't have a pair of pants on. Shelly, roll this.
I never started it. I think that's what they said.
You never did it in the first place?
Yeah, that's what they said in arraignment yesterday.
Okay.
And bench warned a few times.
Okay. Do you have other charges? Have you ever picked up any other charges? Okay, I'm not accepting this sentence. That's ridiculous. No. I'm sentencing you to how long have you been in custody?
They picked me up in Fayette Sunday morning.
And you have no charges anywhere?
No. None. And the jail would also refuse to give her pants and any kind of hygiene products that she needed.
No pants? What?
No, I've been wearing this since I came in with this on Sunday.
Excuse me?
Other hygiene products that she greatly needed and requested. So she's been.
Excuse me? This is outrageous. Is this for real?
All right, so here's what's interesting. Many people have been focused on the fact that she didn't have pants on. What they've overlooked, to your point in the book, she was arrested on a shoplifting charge.
Yep.
She goes to jail. She's there for 3 days. No other offenses. First time offense. The prosecutor, she did complete her diversionary program. Prosecutor says 75 days in jail. And the judge goes, time out. No other charges? Mm-hmm. 75 days in jail? She said, no. $100 fine.
Right, which is what it should be. And that's part of the problem with the system. The ritual humiliation of walking in with no pants is something that we see very often as well. But the fact, as you said, that people are put in jail for too long with no real sentences is ridiculous. But this part of why this happens, and I talk about this in the book, is because the public defender system itself has been broken. You often have overworked public defenders who sometimes have hundreds of cases, and then they outsource them to contract lawyers. And if I'm a contract lawyer and you give me a flat fee to represent as many clients as possible, the profit ain't in giving good investigation or working hard.
No.
It's in getting as many through as fast as possible.
Well, hell, in Louisiana, they just say, look, we can't do any of it. It's all of a sudden people sitting in jail. Right. And look at the young kid who killed himself who's in Rikers Island for allegedly a stolen backpack.
Right.
And again, I mean, we see this over and over and over again. Final comment.
One of the hilarious things we saw in Missouri, that the public defender there challenged the governor, Jay Nixon, to defend some folks for public defense because they ran out of money the same way they did in Louisiana.
Absolutely. Roland, before you, I just want to say this is a pleasure to be on your show. And my mama told me if I ever come anywhere to always bring the person a gift. So I got you something.
And you brought some Kappa thing.
No, I brought you.
It's red. It's red. This is going to be good.
Roland has always wanted to be a member of this fine organization, Kappa Alpha Psi. So I'm going to lay this right here. Maybe when you go to break, you can hold this up. Can you hold this up? Can we get a still of this, Roland Martin?
Let me show y'all something. This is what anything with Kappa is good for.
He disrespected that.
So I need to keep my glass here clean.
I want all the Captain America to see what Roland doing with the cane.
But you know what, though? But here's a piece, though. These are Delta colors.
You came first.
DST, go ahead and say, ooh. See, you're going to go there. All right, then. It's all good, though. Y'all know he just simply couldn't get in the Alpha. Everybody couldn't get in, you know, but had to go to. It's like going to a hot club, and you walk up, and they say, my name on the list, and they go, no, it's not. You got to go to that club down the street. That's Kappa. All right, then. All right, y'all. Secretary of Education, John King, appreciate it, Mark, talks about equity in education. Also, we'll talk with Tika Sumpter Parker Sars about playing First Lady Michelle Obama in the new South Side film, new film South Side with you. All of that next News One Now on TV One. He gonna bring me a Kappa shirt.
What's up? It's your boy Wyclef Jean. You got one vote. Use it.
Wherever you are, we are your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with your host, Roland Martin.
Yesterday, Secretary of Education John King talked about education equity at the National Association of Black Journalists Convention. He had a great conversation with Maria Hinojosa talking about diversity in our schools. Here is a sense of that conversation.
So the three things we're focused at the department, one is equity and excellence throughout our educational system, early childhood, K through 12, higher education. Two is lifting up the teaching profession, and teachers made a huge difference in my life. That's part of why I became a teacher. Teachers are at the core of how we ensure that schools are successful, so lifting up the teaching profession. And then the third is to focus on access, affordability, and completion in higher education. And certainly there's been a lot of conversation in 2016 so far around issues of access and affordability. That's hugely important. It's been a priority from the for the president from the outset. But we've also got to focus on completion. We have too many students who start and don't finish. That's a huge part of our default problem. The students who default on their debt are students often who started, took some credits, dropped out. Now they can't pay off their debt. They don't have the degree, so they can't get the good job, and they're just trapped. And so we've got to do a lot more on completion. We've got to make sure that all teachers are prepared to work with diverse students and prepared to see students as whole human beings and recognize that there's a need for socio-emotional development alongside academic development. That was critical. We got to make sure that schools have the resources that they need to provide a quality, well-rounded education to every student. I was fortunate to have art and music and science and social studies, and we have too many schools where that's not happening. We've got to make sure that students have an opportunity to be challenged, and that we don't have schools giving up on low-income students, students of color, and saying, well, because of their circumstance, they shouldn't get these opportunities. I was fortunate to have the chance to do Shakespeare in elementary school. That was transformative for me. And so we've got to make sure that schools are providing those enrichment opportunities, those academic challenges to all students on an equitable basis. Now, we can't dictate that from the federal level, but I do think how we implement federal laws, federal funding, can push and prod states towards doing the right thing. And then we have a civil rights enforcement role, which is really about saying there are some fundamental protections that students are entitled to, and we're going to ensure those happen. You know, I think of a Midwestern city where we looked at why there were so few Latino students in the advanced STEM program. And this was through our Office of Civil Rights. We found out the information never went home in Spanish. So if parents didn't speak Spanish, they wouldn't know about the advanced STEM program. Consequently, Latino students were underrepresented. So we made them change that. And so that is the civil rights enforcement mechanism is a powerful lever. Schools have a fundamental responsibility to make sure that every child is safe. Schools have a responsibility to act when a racially hostile environment is created. And so we've been clear in our guidance to school districts and states about those responsibilities. They have a civil rights enforcement responsibility. But also as educators, I think we have a responsibility, whether it's talking about elections or talking about these incidents between the community and police over the last few weeks, we have a responsibility to help young people grapple with their world. And sometimes that means we have to try to find ways to explain the unexplainable.
All right, folks, Rhonda Fahmy, Ray Baker, Yolanda Young, as well as Mark Lamont Hill. Here's what I find to be interesting. Education barely mentioned this whole presidential campaign.
Yeah, it's same thing really happened in 08. You know, very little conversation about education. And what's fascinating to me was when McCain and Obama are debating, or right now when Trump and Clinton debate, there's no disagreement on the question of education. That scares me. When Republicans and Democrats agree on something completely with no debate, it usually means there's not a lot of substance.
But here's one of the reasons why you're not going to have a significant discussion about public education in the debates, because frankly, the debate moderators, they kids don't go to public school.
Very true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's something that's there.
It could be. It also, you know, there is some mention, I have to say, on the Republican side, certainly. I'm not sure if Secretary Clinton excuse me, but Donald Trump has mentioned school choice on the issue of education.
That was a drive-by.
And that is, it is an important,
Rhonda,
we can argue about this, but he did mention that, Rhonda, we don't have to argue about school choice.
We don't have to argue about this because I was at the National Charter Schools Conference, which is all about school choice, and we were sitting in our meeting, and when our lead lobbyist told us about what Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump said about school choice, you know what the Trump campaign told us?
What?
We'll talk about that after the election.
But I've heard him talk about it in public rallies.
No, he's not talked about it. He's mentioned it.
And so
I'm saying is the campaign,
the
campaign literally said, we'll get back to y'all after the election.
Exactly. If you just say the word school choice and you don't say what that means, school choice can mean vouchers, it can mean charter schools, it can mean homeschooling, it can mean a lot of things. He's made no explanation of what he even means about school choice.
He hasn't explained anything. That means the government isn't totally able to handle education.
The government hasn't
been doing a great job.
No. If you're going to mention school choice, you need to be specific in terms of what it is. And Donald Trump has not been specific. And the reality is here, hell, if it wasn't for me questioning Hillary Clinton at the town hall in October last year, nobody else would ask about education. And that's a problem for me when it comes to national media. Yolanda and Ray, real quick, final comments on this.
I would have to say, too, he didn't talk about the school-to-prison pipeline, which is a critical issue for me.
Right. I think we've seen the framing only be around student debt, and there has to be more conversation about public education at the K-12 level.
Absolutely.
All right, then, folks, we appreciate it. Thank you so very much. We come back. My homegirl, Tika Sumter, is here. Parker Saw is her co-star. Parker, you ain't going to get much time with Tika here with me. I'm just letting you know. Talking about the new film, Southside, with you. I'm just saying. I'm just keeping it real. Also, Suicide Squad comes out this weekend. Will Smith's new movie. We'll show you my interviews with him as well. News 1 Now on TV 1.
My name is Karen Bass. I'm a member of Congress from Los Angeles, California. And you only have one vote. Use it.
University of Phoenix. We rise.
Wherever you are, we are your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with your host, Roland Martin.
Hi.
Hello.
You're late.
I was hoping you wouldn't notice.
I expected it. You were late for your first day of work.
You noticed that too.
I'm your advisor. I'm supposed to notice. Shouldn't we be getting to the meeting?
We have some time. I thought we'd swing by the art center, see some paintings, maybe grab a bite to eat.
This is not a date. How's it gonna look if I start dating the first cute black guy who walks through the firm's doors? It would be tacky.
You think I'm cute?
I didn't say that.
All right, folks, that's the clip from the new movie, Southside With You, about President Obama and Michelle Obama's first date. Stars of the film, Tika Sumter and Parker Sawyers, joins us right now. What's up, folks?
Hi.
Good morning.
We're having an honorary AK. Yeah, we saw the photo.
I know.
First of all, to have a whole movie around a date is kind of limiting, but it's pretty interesting.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing. Their date was kind of long, and they really got to know each other. And, you know, Richard Tanney, who's the director, you know, he thought this whole thing through, and what kind of conversations that actually brought them to who they are today, you know, would be an interesting take on it. And also, when do you get to see these kind of love stories about us?
True.
Right?
True.
That's right. It was a big date. Big date. First date for the future president and first lady. So, yeah, it was an interesting part in history, I think.
So have either one of you met the president and the first lady?
No, not yet.
I have not. Last night, I went to dinner on the Georgetown waterfront, and we were eating at Nick's Grill, and there was a big commotion down, right next to the restaurant. We said, what's going on? And our server said, oh, Barack Obama's having dinner there for his birthday. It was last night.
We're hoping to get an invite to the party tonight.
Yeah. You didn't go over?
No.
How?
The motorcade, it was blocked off. I couldn't go.
Man, you gotta learn to talk your way into some stuff.
I
talk my way
cousin.
Into the movie.
Yeah, you gotta talk your way into it. So how did you? So it's based on what? So how did you actually prepare for it in terms of trying to understand these two individuals?
Well, for me, there's more video I think of Barack when he was younger, but Michelle, there's not video when she was 25. So it was more reading her brother's book. Game of Character really helped me because it informed me about who she was when she was younger. So I was able to take that and then make it into what I thought she is and was. And then also just looking at her video now of how she talks, you know, I didn't want to do an imitation of her. I wanted to have the essence of her. I wanted to embody her. Mm-hmm. So. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I watched a couple videos that are online of President Barack Obama when he was about 30 years old, 33 years old. And then I just wanted to inject confidence and charisma as he is. And yeah, just sort of.
But see, you got his structure when it comes to the face, but his ear is way bigger than that.
I know.
he's got some huge ears.
They experimented, I mean, the producers with
really? Aesthetic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It did not
right.
work.
No. I mean, I've been in meetings, I'm like, damn, that's some big ears.
Well, he has to listen. Saying, you know, he has a lot know. To listen to. So, yeah.
Well, also, I think what it, first of your point about a love story, the reality is you do not see black love mm-hmm. a lot on the big screen.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you just don't.
Yeah,
no, it's true. And that's one of the main reasons why we decided to do this. I mean, one, it was just a really great script. And then two, to see two people actually conversing and having just real conversations about life, you know, and it's not just a sexual thing. There's an attraction there, but it's bigger than that. So to see that and to have a movie where the whole family can actually go and see it together and be inspired.
You had a little attitude in that clip, too.
I mean, you know, Michelle, but, Barack wasn't her only, like, suitor, you know. He's lucky.
But the attitude does subside throughout
subside,
the film.
It subsides, you know. Okay. Yeah, it subsides. Yeah,
but that is her, though.
Well, good.
That is her. That is her.
I keep hearing, like...
No, that is her. Yeah. No, seriously. So I guess what was that? We were at the Black History Month reception, and so as they were... leaving and going through the elevator. And so I'm staying there. And so, of course, I mean, she's going to walk over, speak, get a hug and everything. Mm-hmm. So she's over here. And he's like, Michelle. She over here talking. She's shaking hands. She's taking pictures. And he's over there, Michelle. She talking hands, shaking pictures. And you can see him like, hell, I might as well go over here and shake hands as
right,
well.
Right.
Like, she was totally ignoring him like, he'll wait.
Right. He'll wait.
And I'm sitting there cracking up laughing.
Great. Like, oh, that makes me happy.
Yes, no.
Yeah.
So that's real.
She's her own woman. You know what I mean? She wasn't chasing. And what I also love about this movie is that, you know, she really is the prize. And a lot of the times we don't see the black woman as the prize in a mm-hmm. lot of these love stories. So it was just nice to see that chase as well.
He had to work.
And
he had
work.
To prove himself, yeah.
Exactly.
All right, then, folks. Southside with you. Hits theaters August 26th. Tika, Parker, we appreciate it. Thanks so much. Always good to see you.
Thank you, Roland.
All right, so normally you'd be here by Skype, actually here in person.
I know.
Well, we come back. We'll talk about Suicide Squad, my chat with Will Smith, Viola Davis, and others right here in News 1 Now on TV 1.
Wherever you are, we are your centerpiece for black thoughts in America. It's News 1 Now with your host, Roland Martin.
New blockbuster, DC Comics, Suicide Squad, action-packed movie, also a little drama as well, about imprisoned supervillains chosen by a secret government agency to execute dangerous and deadly missions in exchange for their freedom. I recently talked to the cast, including Will Smith, Viola Davis, in New York.
Is this the
let me out of here, Donald, please.
Let me out of here right now!
Is this just fantasy?
Get on!
Caught in a landslide. No escape from reality.
Ah! I want to assemble a task force of the most dangerous people on the planet.
They're bad guys. Worst of the worst.
As you look at this film, what makes it so unique and different from your typical Marvel comic book type film?
I think from the outset, it's just an examination of imperfect people. I think that I guess it's the right film for the right time. You know, we've seen a lot of heroes, and that's great. It's something to aspire to.
I can't wait to show you my toys.
And I think it's also impossible to be these perfect icons. So there's something about the bad guys struggling to kind of do something good for a change that we all relate to.
Behold the voice of God.
For those of you who don't know me officially, my name is Amanda Waller.
There's an event in Midway City. I want you to enter the city, rescue HVT1, and get them to safety.
I'm sorry. For those of us who don't speak good guy, what is HVT1?
The only person that matters in the city, the one person you can't kill. Complete the mission, you get time off your prison sentence. Fail the mission, you die.
I mean, I'm sitting there watching, I'm going, okay, they probably are scared of her.
Well, I had no superhuman strengths except for this and this.
So I had to tap into something that was much more formidable and powerful, which is manipulation, lack of fear, being ruthless, unapologetic.
Here's to honor among thieves.
Not a thief. When I saw you
and she's not a thief.
How does it make you feel? Great role, you're grunting, you're swimming, but folks never see your actual face. You're covered up during the whole movie.
You know what? That's why we're doing this.
You're convincing so your family. That was really me.
I'm talking to you so people know it's me. No, listen, I mean, I'm an actor first. Yeah. And this is not my first walk around the park. I was in Marvel, did two of these characters, Al Grimm and Thor. And the reason that I take these parts is because they're characters. It ain't about just having your face all over it. For me, it's about what I can do as an actor, as an artist.
What's also interesting as I watched this film, so you had all these different characters. No one was established as sort of the person we're going to follow. Then all of a sudden, when they come together, they seem to gravitate right behind the Will Smith character.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, Deadshot really carries the theme of the movie, that idea of redemption and that idea of, you know, if you're a bad guy, can you change? Can you do some good?
This dude's gonna get a sore throat from all the singing he's about to do.
You son of a...
Unless you're doing business with your auntie.
In terms of Deadshot, that was his daughter was his one tether to humanity. If he didn't have a daughter, it was like this right. world would pay for everything it ever did to him. But because of this little girl, and it's interesting, he thinks of her as an Achilles heel.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, I could be a great killer if I just wasn't tied to this little girl.
You disobey me, you die. You try to escape, you die. You otherwise irritate or vex me, and guess what? You die.
I'm known to be quite vexing. I'm just forewarning you.
Lady, shut up!
And then, of course, you were way too silly in this film.
Yeah, she's kind of nuts. But I love that side of Holly, but David continually pushes me to the darker side of Holly, which is really fun, too.
Well, it was, and of course, you know, just the constant back and forth. So at one point did he say, okay, you are really cracking, throwing out too many one-liners. Because the folks in the movie theater were cracking up laughing.
I know, I feel like I got all the trailer lines. Like, I remember doing them being like, that's a line up in the trailer, I reckon. Sweet.
Did you ever tell David, can I get one?
I never speak.
Am I just killing everybody?
Paid by
slicing
what?
And dicing.
You're going somewhere very bad to do something that'll get you killed. But until that happens, you're my problem. Mm.
So was that like a pep talk?
Yeah, it was pep talk.
Grab what you need for a fight. We're wheels up in 10.
You might want to work on your team motivation thing. You heard of Phil Jackson?
Yeah.
He's like the gold standard, okay? Triangle.
So if you look at every character, they all had the comedic moments,
mm-hmm.
except you.
Yeah, that's
there were,
right.
That was not even one comedic moment.
Yeah. I feel like in some ways he was a bit of a rock, you know, stationary mm-hmm. rock in this like river that's flowing, and the river is like mm-hmm. the squad and all the madness, and he's almost centered in a way, you know, there's this self judgment
mm-hmm.
and this like idea that like some of these guys don't really care. I think you have it more than anybody else, mm-hmm. but they're just this wild motley crew and you know. I feel like Diablo doesn't want to be a part of it because he's too dangerous to be a part of it. He's too dangerous to open up. If you say something funny, that's allowing somebody into you in some way, right? And I think that was a dangerous thing for him.
He didn't want to go that far. You're like, dude,
I kind of need you to get in the game.
I know, yeah. No, it's like his Jay's character, El Diablo, was the one when David first pitched to me. I was like, oh, I want that. I want to play that guy.
Yeah, yeah. El Diablo. I remember you saying that.
I was like,
the first time I was like, that's pretty awesome.
Yeah, that character is the best. That, you know, just he's the one character in the crew that has spiritual power, right? So he's on that next level, and it's just the pain and the ideas around redemption. Mm-hmm. You know, is there a spot or a time when you've been so bad that you become unredeemable? And if you are redeemable, what will it take to gain that redemption? And his character illustrates it in a beautiful way.
We're the Patsies, the cover up. Don't forget, we're the bad guys.
It was also interesting in terms of this whole dynamic where you had each one of these characters who had something that was personal, that was wholly separate from the evil in which they operated in.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the movie's really about redemption, and there's people that have done bad things in their lives, and at what point do you just give up on them? And at what point do they give up on themselves? And even though these are bad guys, you know, they do have good hearts, and they learn that, you know, they can, you know, be forgiven for what they've done, and they can come together, form their own family, and they can achieve some good.
Don't forget, Suicide Squad opens in theaters this weekend. I'll be back. News 1 Now TV 1 in 60 seconds.
Kickstart your day at 7 and get the news you need from the perspective you want. News 1 Now with Roland Martin, every weekday morning at 7 on TV 1.
Birthday shout-out time. New Orleans Saints running back C.J. Spiller turns 29. Actor Jesse Williams turns 35. Comedian DeRay Davis turns 48. NBA Hall of Famer Patrick Ewing turns 54. And actress Janet Dubois turns 71. All right, folks, we will see you guys next week. We'll have more from NABJ. Ava DuVernay and others will be with us. Gotta bring the funk as we do it. Holla!
Kickstart your day at 7 and get the news you need from the perspective you want. News 1 Now with Roland Martin, every weekday morning at 7 on TV 1.